We're just going to share some experiences and thoughts and reflections and tips about the Anapanasati Sutta. And I must say that I'm personally more familiar through the kind of 20 years or so that I've been practicing meditation and Buddhism. I was introduced to the mindfulness of breathing straight on, actually. And as we know, Anapanasati and mindfulness of breathing isn't that far apart. And then at some point I was introduced to the Satipatthana Sutta, the four foundations of mindfulness. People probably have heard about it. And so the first foundation to be aware of is the body, all the contemplations of the body, etc. And then the next realm that you pay attention to is the realm of the sensations in the body, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So that's the second foundation. And then the third foundation is about experiencing emotion and the mind and the heart. It's that kind of, it's heart-mind. Buddhism only has one word for it. I think most of us know that. It's the word citta, translated as like heart / mind. And then lastly, that the fourth foundation of mindfulness is about it's looking at your experience through the teachings of the Buddha, so the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, or the teachings about the hindrances, the Bodhiyangas. We had a retreat recently, and Ratna Prabhu gave us a very good introduction to the factors of enlightenment. So that's the Satipatthana, but somehow the Anapanasati combines the two. So it just seems to me, at least how I view it, it's that if you add being aware of the breath to all these different foundations of mindfulness, you kind of end up with the Anapanasati Sutta. Anyway, that's my experience of it. So I just wanted to give you a little history of me and the Anapanasati Sutta. Because the first time I was really properly introduced to the sutta, it was 2003, so that was 15 years ago, isn't it? And I did a retreat, a month retreat in Spain. Some people might have heard of a retreat centre that's there. It's called Kujalloka. And the retreat I went on was adjacent to, in a valley adjacent to that other retreat centre. We're just the 10 of us for a month, concentrating on the Anapanasati Sutta. And the book that we used at the time is called Breath by Breath by Larry Rosenberg. So this is actually my old copy that I used when I was on that retreat. And I just thought, to share some of the experiences of that retreat. I thought you might find them amusing. So I've also been here. I found my notebook for 2003. Mm-hmm. So here's my notes that I made on the retreat, which is so lovely to look back. And the interesting thing for me is first to discover, so this is an Anapanasati retreat, and the most of the things I've been doing on the retreat is working with metta. Yeah, so I wasn't particularly working with the Anapanasati. It was like doing metta the whole retreat. I was concentrating on metta, which I found quite amusing to discover that. And I found, for instance, a list of images I made on the retreat that evoked metta for me. And I'm still using it sometimes in the meditation today. So I thought I'll share some of these images. I don't know whether they do it for you, but they do it for me. There was a small blue butterfly that had landed on my sandal. It was so hot, that retreat. It was the hottest June in many, many years. So there was this small blue butterfly that had landed on my sandal. Somehow that evoked metta in me. And it was one of my friends, and she was it was silence, a month's silence, and one of my friends was imitating a bird. So that was also went on my list of images of metta. And there was a field of poppies that went on the list. And also what went on the list is another friend who was washing his feet in a bowl of water. So I just thought, I don't know, it's just personal, isn't it, to us? And anyway, I also found a list of words that evoke metta. So I've been really working very hard with the metta on that retreat. And another thing that I found extremely amusing is when I read my notes, there's so many notes about insects. And so I found this description of what was happening for me. So there's lots of insects creeping and flying and buzzing and stinging and humming and flittering. So there's all these insects there. And it was hell sometimes because they creep on the soles of your feet. They were in your face and on your nose and in your nose and in your ears. So all of that was actually, that was a lot of my experience was just unpleasant, very unpleasant. But in my memory of that retreat, I had a lot of absorbed, pleasant, meditative states. So my memory of that retreat is that was the retreat where I had so many pleasant, absorbed, meditative states. And in the months after that, there was a stream, it seemed like a stream of fresh air flowing through my experience as a result of having had such absorbed states in the meditation. So I thought that was quite interesting that I think we often do that. We kind of filter out all sort of elements from our experience and kind of end up with some sort of overall kind of label. Yeah, anyway, it's quite interesting, I thought, to notice that. And I also noted some of the benefits, and so for some of these benefits, it does obviously also relate to practicing the Anapanasati Sutta. So some of the benefits I found during that month was just trusting in the practice. So trust in the practice, whatever practice I was doing, just trust that when I'm doing it, it's going to lead to a good place, it's going to lead to a place of, I don't know, more truthfulness, more openness. And also another observation I made is on that retreat I was more and more able to experience anger because that was something that I hadn't really been able to do very much at all in the years before that. So a lot of anger came up on that retreat, but it was very helpful. So I also discovered on that retreat how being able to experience my mind is of great benefit to myself and to my relationship with other people. So I think we touched upon that when we were going through the Anapanasati Sutta, that, you know, just knowing the truth of your own experience and really being able to see, to be open to your own experience rather than pushing it away, repressing it, just being there with your experience, how incredibly healing and wholesome that hopefully is eventually. It might not be pleasant, but wholesome I think it is. And then also, this is another observation, the mind is very banal. It's incredibly banal. I just couldn't believe how banal it is. So I was kind of writing down this thing about every moment is in principle rich material to practice with, so it's best to practice in the here and the now. And then I'm writing, so now I'm going to go to the toilet. Anyway, so yes, I really noticed that it's life, isn't it? One day we're kind of in these elevated states, and the next it's like, yeah, just you got to go to the toilet, yeah, something like that. And also what I noticed is that ignoring the hindrances is just not working. It's just not working to ignore the hindrances that come up in the meditation. You just do have to. You can't just kind of ignore them and think, oh, I'm going to go back to the breath. Mm-hmm. Shut up, shut up, shut up. Back to the breath, 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 breath. Shut up, shut up, shut up. It's not working. So I found that out in my experience that is not working. Also, I found that my mind was becoming more flexible. And I think before I went on that retreat, I hadn't really been aware how rigid my mind actually was. So just through the practice, and especially through the practice of breathing, there's something about the practice of breathing, if you pair it with experiencing the mind, because of that motion of the breathing, it just brings more... It makes the whole experience more supple and pliable and flexible. It's really interesting how that seems to work, but I found it worked like that. And also something I noticed is that, in me at least at that point, impatience is a source of restlessness. I so clearly could see that the restlessness in my body was completely connected to having impatient states of mind. And the impatient states of mind, all the insects on my feet and the kind of like, you know, the physical discomfort, it was just so, I was just getting really irritated by all of that, and it made it sometimes impossible to meditate. But what I found so interesting, that actually these severe feelings of discomfort were like a form of self-hatred. If you see what I mean, it's like you're kind of torturing yourself if you're kind of irritated in that kind of way. So obviously just experiencing it with much more equanimity is a much better way forward, and is going to allow you to be much more relaxed. That's all very obvious. But it's just interesting how sometimes restlessness, impatience, it can sometimes translates as a feeling of restlessness in the body. So yeah, just interesting, I thought. And another thing that I found really interesting to discover, and I described it somewhere in my notes, that I'm saying, even if I sit among the ruins, so to speak, I can still follow the fragile thread of my breathing. And that I found extremely interesting. So even if there's such a huge stuff going on, there's havoc, there's extreme agitation, whatever, it's still possible to keep that connection going with the mindfulness and awareness of the breath. So, and I think that's certainly relevant for our topic of today, the Anapanasati. So, later on, I've done some other retreats where we would be going through the Anapanasati, but because I was going to do the talk, I have been doing the practice fairly regularly in the last week, because obviously I don't feel I can start, you know, talk about this practice if I haven't actually done the practice. So I've done the practice in the past week, and just every morning I did 40 minutes, the same as how we've been doing it in the Let Through practice. I was using the same instructions. And I just thought I'd share a few of my observations during my last week of practicing. See what you think of that. Well, one thing that I thought is valuable to share from that is, this is based on a wrong assumption. I can be a bit of a perfectionist, I'm afraid. I'm a recovering perfectionist. Much easier. So sometimes people say, yeah, they're kind of, yeah, I've got high standards. But that's sort of sometimes quite hard on myself to have high standards, if you see what I mean. So somehow, I think I've had this expectation that, particularly with practices like Anapanasati, which can read a bit linear, so you move from one stage to another, that you need to kind of have this perfect experience of one stage before you move to the other. You see what I mean? I can't be the only one who's got something similar. Like, for instance, you do some sort of practice and you're supposed to be completely aware of your body. And then, you know, if you've got that kind of mindset, it's hard to move on to the next stage if you don't feel secure in knowing now I'm completely aware of my body. So something to just letting that go is extremely helpful. So you could just do the practice. You don't have to do the stages perfectly, but you could still do them. So you don't need to do the meditation perfectly anyway. So I just wanted to, at this stage, plug this other book, which I can't see where it's at. It's gone. Maybe it's oh, it's here, under my knee. Yeah, I just thought, for those of you who are more experienced meditators, I'd just like to plug this book. And it's by Jason Siff, and it's called Unlearning Meditation. Unlearning Meditation. I would really recommend it if you have a practice going, have had a practice going for a few years, because we start doing the practice, and then we might start in the beginning to take things quite literally. So we end up in our meditation practice years down the line of having to undo the literal way we interpreted the instructions in the first place, if you see what I mean. So the instruction that I was just talking about, like, you've got to have the first phase covered before you can move to the next, that would be something that you could unlearn, if you see what I mean. So I think this is a useful book to read, to examine how to deal with instructions in the meditation, because I personally often find it quite unpleasant to have instructions in the meditation, because half of the time, or 95% of the time actually, I'm just not there. They're moving to this next stage and just nowhere there at all. So somehow just letting that go, yeah, was a good discovery for me in the last. Thank you so much for inviting me to do this. Otherwise I would not have discovered that in this way. And also maybe in the same category, awareness. I'm trying to find a better word, because you could say you've got light and heavy. It doesn't quite work. I'll try to explain what I mean. Is you could have a light awareness and you could have a completely absorbed awareness. You see the difference. So there is that scale of being aware, being mindful, being absorbed. It starts somewhere with being a little absorbed, a little aware, a little kind, whatever. And then it kind of goes on to the full spectrum of being completely mindful. If you see full-blown blast of mindfulness, it's okay to just have that very light awareness initially. You just have the touch, a touch of awareness, rather having the full sort of everything, you know, all guns blazing kind of thing. So I think that is also something useful to realize in a meditation practice, that it's okay if it's just that kind of tiny thread of mindfulness of the breath coming through, a tiny amount of intention to be kind coming through. Yeah, that's what it is. It's fine. So yeah, another thing I thought I'd share. The practice really works. It's amazing. It really is amazing. You just go through these instructions, and you know, every time I was doing the practice, I went from, well, maybe I was a bit dull and a bit uninspired or a bit sleepy. So I started with the practice and taking it sort of fairly lightly, not expecting to accomplish anything or to achieve anything, just going through the instructions and see where I was going. And every time, at the end, I felt inspired and I discovered something about the mind. I discovered something that was important, I felt, for my experience. So, yeah, that's how that's... I mean, it's a very old practice, so I shouldn't be surprised that it works. But I was actually amazed that normally I don't really respond to that kind of linear type of practices. And I think maybe in the past, when I was introduced to this practice, I wasn't quite ready for it in that kind of way. Sometimes, you know, you're introduced to a practice, you're just not really, it doesn't really work for you at that point. It needs to be coming at the right time. Yeah, I don't know whether people recognize that. Yeah. And another thing that I thought I'd share is what I'm working with right now. Sometimes you have this kind of real focus, I think, in the practice. You've got something that you're really working with or want to work with. So what I am working with right now is to just experience, allow experience to arise without wanting to change it, which is kind of quite a high goal, I think. But it's probably a bit similar to, as I understand, enlightenment. Things just arise and you don't want to be different from how they actually are. But anyway, that's what I'd like to aspire to, experience just arising without me pushing it away or trying to hold on to it. It just is what it is, as it were. So that's what I'm working with. But what I found in doing the practice in this past week, that it is just completely possible just to receive experience, be completely open to it, and then yet sort of kind of gently ignore a kind of a voice that says, this needs to be different, I don't want this, this needs to be this, that and the other, to just see that kind of influence coming into the mind in the meditation as, yeah, okay, I respect it, it's there, but I don't have to go with it, I don't have to listen to it, I can just acknowledge it and just continue doing what I was doing, namely following the breath. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Yeah. See, enough nods to encourage me to mm-hmm. I can move on to the next topic. Yeah, so you can just very friendly disentangle from any kind of distraction, respect it, and then on the back of that, or just alongside of that, gently encourage rapture or relaxation to come into experience. So yeah, that is some of the things I learned doing the practice in the past week, and I was just ever so happy that I had the opportunity to go into this material again. So I think the brief for tonight was to give this summary, and I hope I've given a bit of a summary here and there. And I was also asked to talk a bit about the practice in daily life, so I'm moving on to that topic about using the Anapanasati practice in daily life. And actually, that book by Larry Rosenberg, I had another look at it, and it has this whole chapter about using the practice in daily life. So guess what? I've been reading that, and I've got some tips enhanced with my own observations, obviously. But yeah, I've got some tips from Larry and me. One of the things that he's particularly stressing is that we seem to make this big difference between our sitting life and our daily life. I don't know whether people actually do that, but I have seen it around me, and I do think it could be a tendency that people feel, okay, now I'm sitting on my cushion, and when I'm off the cushion, there just don't seem to be related somehow. I don't know whether anybody experiences this or has observed it. And also this idea that here on the cushion, the meditation, that's where it's happening. It's all happening here on the cushion. So there's a bit of maybe a tendency to underestimate all the practice that we can do in our daily lives. Mm. And a bit of a disdain maybe for, oh my God, I'm meditating, I don't want to do the washing up. I'm meditating, I don't want to clean the toilets. So I'm meditating, I don't want to speak to my mother. Rewind. Yeah. So that's just interesting to see. Is that something that you're doing? Is that something that you think is the case? Because what the tradition suggests is that mindfulness obviously is not only happening on the cushion. The whole idea is that we extend it into daily life, and the daily life is completely chock-a-block full of opportunities to be mindful. This is our practice. Daily life is actually, that is our practice. So we're sitting on a cushion and we're doing our practice in daily life. And one isn't worth more than the other. That's what's been suggested. And Kamala Sheila told me a year ago, so he'd gone to see a talk by a Burmese meditation master. And his meditation master is saying that he felt that being mindful in daily life was more important than the meditation. And that the monks, they're all looking really grumpy and shaking their heads when he said that. But actually, I know, it's quite interesting, isn't it, that he said that. Yes, so practicing mindfulness in daily life is just as important as us trying to sit on the cushion and follow the breath or whatever we're doing on that cushion. So the Buddha says, being mindful in all postures, not only when you're sitting in meditation, but also in lying down, standing, walking, etc. Whatever we're doing, really, where we're talking to someone, And it's a huge, huge piece of work, isn't it? Mm. It's a huge piece of work. If you think about all the realms of our lives and the realms where we are more mindful and less mindful. And I just thought I'd just for a few minutes, I just invite you to just reflect a bit on your life and just for yourself, just notice, think about which areas in my life do kind of deserve a bit more mindfulness. Where in my life, which areas in my life is there a lack of mindfulness? Just see. Just something to take away and see if there's anything you can do with that. And also, this is also an observation that Larry Rosenberg makes in his chapter, that some people see the formal meditation and the going on retreats as a way of healing. So they go on a lot of retreats and then coming back into daily life, it's all, you know, a bit of a blast, it's difficult, if you want support, etc., etc. So somehow, in the course of the life of a practitioner of meditation, somebody who goes off on retreats, that needs to balance itself out a bit more somehow. It isn't in essence so very different to be on retreat or to lead your daily life. So if you do notice that tendency in yourself, it would be just interesting to see how that works. So obviously it's really good and healing to go on a retreat, but also, don't underestimate all the benefits of mindfulness in your normal sort of daily off a retreat life. And personally, I think I went on my first retreat at the end of 96. The end of 96 was my first retreat. And coming back from that retreat, there was a massive, massive difference between being on retreat and my life. It felt just incredible, very daunting, and became dizzy even looking at that gap. But now, now it's just much more even, as it were. The difference is much less strong between being on retreat and not being on retreat. Just so something to observe and something to work with, that both practice on the cushion, on retreat, and daily life are valuable for us as practitioners. I think I've made my point now, haven't I? Probably hammered it in a bit too much, but that is the point here. Awareness of breath, you can just bring to anything. There isn't any activity that you can't bring awareness of the breath to. It's just quite amazing. For instance, you could use this, if we're talking about how to use the practice in our daily lives. I don't know how about you, but sometimes you might find yourself talking to someone and you're getting a bit upset or a bit triggered or something of that nature. Yeah, maybe people have noticed that happening. So in that moment that you're noticing that you're getting a bit triggered or angry, that is a moment, if you remember, to bring in the awareness of the breath, just very gently. It's not like you're not going to stop listening to them or you're out of contact, but you could just gently turn the attention in and start following the breath. And is it called the breathing space? Is that what it's called? Or is that there is that kind of a little breather that you can do in a conversation of going in and following the breath a few times? So that just to use that, if we have that as an instrument or a tool to help us in our daily lives when we're upset or triggered or irritated or whatever in a conversation. So yeah, let's just, yeah. I mean, I think it's fantastic. It's fantastic that we have such a tool, because it's such a powerful tool. It immediately starts to take away the sting out of the situation. At least we'll try it out. Try it out and see if it works for you. So the mindfulness of the breath is meant to aid your mindfulness and not to hinder it. So obviously, if you're talking to someone and all of a sudden you go into deep samadhi because you're kind of concentrating on breath, that's not what we're talking about. We're talking again about like a light awareness of the breath. And it's interesting to take this up as a practice, to try it one day. I tried this on Saturday, actually. So you're just undertaking to be aware of the breath the entire day. That was my idea for Saturday. So I tried to follow the breath the whole day on Saturday. And anyway, I think it occurred a few times in the day that I lost the breath for about 3 hours. Completely lost the breath. Which is like, okay, it's hilarious, actually, isn't it? That, yes, of course, you can say, oh, now I'm going to be mindful of the breath. But it's like, it's conditioned, isn't it? And then I think the art is to just, you know, there's no use judging yourself, because it's not like you can switch it on and off just like that. You're training yourself to be mindful, but it's interesting maybe to try it out one day to see where is it lost and when does it come back again. It's just interesting. So yeah, you could try that out, see if it works or when it works. But also, if you want to do it a bit more, less ambitious maybe than I've done, you can pick one particular activity to start with. So just pick one activity. It could be the washing up, or, you know, it could be the walking to the tube in the morning, whatever. Pick an activity and then try to do it then. Just bring in that awareness of the breath. It's a kind of very gentle training. And we have these empty, dead moments in the day that we could perfectly use for this type of practice. And the thing is, this is what I found so fascinating doing the practice, because I started doing this a few times, you know, after Saturday. I didn't sort of undertake to do the whole day, but now and again, because I'd been training it on the Saturday, it came in. I remembered the days after as well to sometimes do this. So when I remember to do that, I started to go into the breath. And then the moment I started to do that, I experienced joy. It was just amazing. Just joy came instantly. And I think, why did it come? Because I'd been doing the practice, because I'd been training for a few days to do the practice. So that's the kind of the results of the practice. And it's not like it was a joy that was like, you know, the rest of the day was fantastic. It wasn't like that, but it is a real strong sense of well-being. So that's fascinating, isn't it, that a little training can go a long way. I think we already knew that, but I'm just saying. Yeah. So yes, again, any kind of time in the day, especially if it's time that you usually, you know, we've got time that we find is really unpleasant and we really dislike it in the day.
I don't know.
Yeah, it might be on the tube back, especially if it's the central line on rush hour or something. It's very unpleasant. I find that one of the most unpleasant things that you can do, go on the central line in rush hour. Something like that. Something that is normally a time where you feel claustrophobic or kind of agitated or whatever in a particular situation. Or another thing, I don't know about you, but like watching the status bar on your computer, yeah? If you kind of update it, you know, you're working, but your computer needs to be updated, and then it takes like a really long time. And you want it to come back online because you need to finish some work, you know that? So time like that, you could just bring in the awareness of the breath in time like that. Mm. It completely transforms it. It's amazing, I find. Yeah. And also, you can use this going back to the breath between meeting up with people. I had on yesterday, I think I had 3 one-to-ones, 2 meetings and a study group. So that was quite a lot for me. I'm kind of basically introverted in terms of I get my energy from being on my own and processing my own thoughts. I need a bit of alone time often. So for me, that can be quite challenging. Other people like, fantastic day. Completely energized after a day like that. I feel fairly drained after a day like that. But to help it a bit, to help myself a bit, going back to the breath between meeting people, it really works. And I've done this myself sometimes when I'm on the team for a meditation retreat and I'm doing the meditation reviews with people. So, you know, you'd see about 5 people, everybody's got 10 minutes. So between people, yeah, just to go back to the breath, just to go back to the breath, it really helped being present with the next person and kind of letting go of the other person, the first person, if you see what I mean. So yeah, there's something that you could use in that transition time between meeting people. It helps, I think, it energizes. Okay. And also, and this is more in the area of ethics. So sometimes you find yourself in a situation where it's fairly easy to go on a slippery slope as far as ethics go. You could just use your imagination here, I don't know. A situation, I think particularly a situation, I've got to totally learn this myself. I'm going to use this myself so much. There is that sort of urge to say something when you're maybe annoyed or irritated. So if it were at all possible to remember the breath then, that's going to be extremely helpful, isn't it? Connecting to the breath in a moment like that will just give a bit of time, create a bit of space, and then whatever you wanted to say is not going to be said, and that's probably going to be better, yeah? If you see what I mean, that's just about speaking, or it could be all sorts of speech, couldn't it? It could be all sorts of speech, but speaking is a difficult one, isn't it? Because it's so easy to say something that pops up in your head. So, yeah, to use that, use the breath, going back to the breath in ethically challenging situations. Yeah, and so it could give you a bit of a space around words. And personally, I'm more used to using the breath in, I don't know, some of you might have heard about this practice called Tonglen. Some people probably have heard of this practice called Tonglen, where you're using the breath to connect to pain and you're breathing out spaciousness, whatever is needed in a situation. I'm more familiar with using that in terms of if I have a conversation with someone, I remember this and I'm getting a bit triggered or irritated, or I find it a bit difficult to start breathing that in, that difficulty, that pain, and breathing out some sort of spaciousness or friendliness or kindness. That also helps the situation along. It's just it's just something that I've been finding personally quite helpful, to use the breath like that in situations like that. And I just wanted to say something as well about mindfulness. And you know, I said how I would lose the breath for about 3 hours and then come back to it. Breath or the mindfulness, everything according to the Buddha is conditioned, dependent on conditions. So mindfulness itself is also conditioned. So it's not like, as I said, we can't switch it off or on when we need it. It'll come and it'll go. And also you can imagine that it is not really possible to be mindful 100% of the time. So it would be a bit like, I often think about practicing mindfulness or kindness like going to the gym. You know, you're not going to go to a 24-hour gym and work out the whole time. Because it wouldn't be good for the body, yeah? So something about that, using that mindfulness muscle, as it were, it seems to be the case that sometimes it's kind of not there, it's very low, as it were, and sometimes it's much stronger. There's a teaching in Tibetan Buddhism, it's called the Evam teaching. I don't know whether you heard about this, but Evam, the E, it's spelled E, and then there's a hyphen and V-A-M. The E represents a spaciousness, and the Vam represents focus. So it seems to be the case that the mind, if you observe the mind, how it evolves, what's happening, that it kind of goes into spaciousness and then it goes into focus, and it goes into spaciousness and it goes into focus. And this is a natural movement of the mind. Mm. So we can't expect ourselves to always be in that focus. Sometimes we're in the spaciousness, if you see what I mean. And then we just got to know this is spacious. This is spacious mind. This is might be really wide kind of, very light kind of mindfulness. And there is no focus or concentration here right now. Sometimes it just is like that. Yeah? So, yeah, I think that's really good, just not to have those huge expectations of yourself in relation to mindfulness that comes up. Yes, so sometimes we are just distracted, and then fantastic, if you're noticing I'm distracted, I don't follow the breath, come back to it. Great. That's fantastic, isn't it? You remembered. Not like giving yourself a hard time because you haven't remembered, if you see what I mean. Yeah, so just a few more points here. Just 3 more points. Larry Rosenberg made a really interesting point. I found this is fascinating. He is saying that just like in the breath, you need to exhale the whole breath in order to take a new breath. He's saying you also need to do this with experience. I thought that was really, really interesting point he made. So you need to exhale your old experience in order to make space for a new experience. If you don't exhale the old experience completely, there'll be remnants of the old experience in the new experience that comes up. And it sounds a bit idealistic, and I thought it's an interesting point, because it is, I think, encouraging us to let go, just not to hold on, to let go, just let go of stuff. So, thought it was a really good point, actually. Found it quite inspiring. So, and in the practice of the breathing, or in the practice of meditation, I think that's also fascinating, for me it's fascinating at least, is that the meditation can completely change from one moment to another. So you could just sit there feeling like completely frustrated and, you know, wound up, and there's only anger, and this, and then it could just it could just completely turn around. And just knowing that that is the way it could work, I find that quite liberating. Just knowing that that experience can just turn around, just like that. So it doesn't have to be that the next breath is also going to be a breath with anger and frustration. The next breath could be completely new breath with new experience, something completely different arising. So yeah, that is just amazing. And I actually tried this out today. We had this meeting here today, a short meeting. Oh, it was an hour's meeting. I came back into the center to have this really intense hour meeting, and I went back home to prepare my talk. And in that meeting, I must say, I felt extremely irritated. And sometimes that kind of spilled over. Anyway, I'm not proud of myself, but you know, anyway, it spilled over. So I was kind of walking to the tube and thinking, well, I'm preparing this talk. I need to prepare my talk. And I thought, I've got to prepare my talk right now, because I'm just going to do the Anapanasati Sutta now. I'm going to do it. So I was just walking to the tube here to Royal Oak, working with my irritation. Breathing in and breathing out, breathing in. And I wrote down the sequence when I was home. So how did I do that? I connected to the breath. I was feeling the breath in the body, allowing the breath to calm down the body. And I was connecting to pleasant experience. I was connecting to joy. I was experiencing the whole sort of energy body direction of the mind. I was allowing the mind to become more absorbed. I was experiencing and acknowledging the truth of my mind at that particular moment. And I started to see the mind as conditioned. And I started to see this is not mine. And I started to see how it all is impermanent. And I watched it fading away. I watched it stopping. And I was letting it go. I was letting go of the pushing and the pulling I was doing on the tube, that was. And then when I was home, it kicked in again. I started to get irritated again. But then I started doing the practice again. But so you can do this practice on the tube. You can do it walking from here to anywhere. So you don't necessarily have to do this practice on the cushion. So I thought that was actually... yeah, that's really helpful. And I was actually traveling home, doing the practice, and preparing my talk all at the same time. So, yeah, I was quite happy with that. I was pleased with that.
Multitasking.
Yay! Not really, but maybe, yeah. Okay, so I just finished by... this is another quote. This is one quote from Larry Rosenberg's book. What he is saying... what it all comes down to, I always like that, just like this one phrase that describes everything, but this is the one at this moment. He's saying, our challenge is always the same, to be with each moment as it is. Our challenge is always the same, to be with each moment as it is. Because I found that in my 2003 notes, I found that description... and I've written it down a few times. I'm sitting on that cushion, and after an hour of pushing and pulling and blah, 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 I've all of a sudden find out, actually, this is what's happening. I just want it to be different. I just want this experience to be different. And that's the cause of our suffering, basically. It is the cause of our suffering, the mismatch between what we're actually experiencing and what we want to experience. Yeah, something about that. So, yeah. So thank you very much, Larry Rosenberg. Yeah, that was the end of my talk. Thank you.